Hopkins. Bryant for the win.
Interviews from your favorite local coaches and athletes.
He's getting to the basket of will, and he's hitting that three-point shot with some consistency now, and he's just in a groove right now where he's pretty well unstoppable.
Hall of Fame and legendary guests.
I was driven by loving to play, liking the challenge of being an NFL quarterback, but after 18 years, I was 1 month short of 39 years old. It's time to go.
Analysis and insight on the latest national sports topics.
Sean Payton was horrible in clock management. That should never be the case with this New Orleans Saints team.
Well, we're waiting.
Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
Welcome into a brand new edition of Drive Time Sports. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini. As always, happy to be along with you on the afternoon drive. Got a fun show lined up today. We're only 2 days away from getting live sports back. UFC is going to make its return, a pay-per-view in Jacksonville coming up this Saturday. One of the names on that card, on the main card, is Greg Hardy, former NFL defensive end. He's going to be on there. The main event, Tony Ferguson and Justin Gaethje. Ferguson 26-3, Gaethje 21-2. Also, you'll see Henry Cejudo going up against Dominic Cruz. So it is a good card for the UFC. So we will talk MMA on the show today. In fact, next segment, Larry Pepe, great friend of mine, excellent, excellent MMA mind. He's going to call and join us to talk about this weekend's pay-per-view. We're starting to get back to the idea of live sports, be it UFC this week, NASCAR next weekend, PGA Tour in about a month. We're starting to get back to the norm somewhat. And so, of course, I'm looking forward to that conversation today. Should definitely be a fun one with Larry Pepe. Again, that's coming up next segment. Also, I talked about this yesterday. I wanted to take a trip down memory lane, spark some nostalgia, talk about things that we loved as kids in the realm of sports. Today, we're going to focus on starting lineups. Remember the Kenner toys, starting lineups? I still have hundreds of those things. Still in the box. I was weird as a kid. I had my open starting lineups, but for the most part, I kept them all sealed. They were fun to collect. It was different than a pack of cards. Honestly, I think if I had my choice, at least back in the day, between a pack of cards or a starting lineup, I probably would roll with the starting lineup. They were just cool because you got a card with the figure. Right? If you don't know what I'm talking about, the Kenner toys, they came out, three, 4 years after the Return of the Jedi. Kenner had the Star Wars toy line. That's a phenomenal story in itself. But starting lineups were debuted in 1988. And I have tried to get the creator of starting lineups on this show, Pat McAnally, who played for the Cincinnati Bengals. He was an All-American at Harvard. I've tried to get him on the show. Unfortunately, I've not been able to come in contact with him. But Pat's got a tremendous story as well. And so I'm looking forward to this conversation. We're going to talk about starting lineups and the Holy Grail. If you have a set of 1988 starting lineups featuring Thurl Bailey, John Stockton, Karl Malone, and Mark Eaton, you have a gold mine. We'll talk about why that is. People from all over the country who collect starting lineups would love to come in contact with that set. Unfortunately, it's almost impossible. I don't even know if the Eaton and Baileys even exist still to this day. That's going to be a fun conversation. That's coming up on the show in just a bit. Let's take a look at some of the national headlines, and we will begin in the NFL. Jim Harbaugh, head coach of the Michigan Wolverines, wrote an open letter today to address the college football community and laying out proposals that would provide a bit more flexibility for players who were thinking about making the jump to pro football despite having college eligibility. This is a conversation that no matter how many people you talk to, somebody's got a different opinion on what the eligibility rules should be for a kid. You know, right now you have to play X amount of years in college before you can make the jump to the NFL. Here's part of the open letter. Harbaugh said, "There are early bloomers capable of competing in the NFL and earning a livelihood at an earlier age. The goal would be to create a scenario that makes adjustments for all current and future student athletes that puts the timeline for transition to professional football at their discretion and that of their family. I propose an option that allows them to make the decision that is best for them." So basically what Harbaugh is saying, he would like to see rules that would allow college football players to talk with agents for advice before signing professional contracts. And as long as the athlete doesn't receive any compensation, they could go back to college. Harbaugh believes a player should be allowed to enter his name into the draft and then return to school if he's not picked in the seven rounds of the draft. That would be extremely interesting, wouldn't it? For instance, take a kid like Jake Fromm this year, who dropped down draft boards. Fromm still had 1 year of eligibility. At one time, it was thought that maybe Fromm could be a second, third-round pick, maybe. Well, that wasn't the case. Once you get to rounds 5, 6, and 7, if you're Fromm, you're probably hoping that you don't get selected so you can go back to Georgia. That's a different take on the NFL draft. If a player is selected in the draft or signs as a free agent, he would then give up the rest of his college eligibility under Harbaugh's plan. Now, the draft age is something that's been a topic for a very long time. Half of college coaches support the idea of allowing players to head to the NFL whenever they want. You want to do it right out of high school, go right ahead. Coaches who support that idea see it as an alternative to allowing college players to profit while they're at the university. And that's where it makes an awful lot of sense. Now, again, I go back to an interview that we had with Oliver Luck, who was the commissioner of the now defunct XFL. And I asked him, the NFL has these eligibility rules. A player has to play 2 to 3 years in the college game before he can go to the NFL. Would you guys allow kids to leave, make that jump whenever they would like? And Oliver Luck said, we would take it on a player-by-player basis. Yes, we would if we deemed that kid physically and mentally capable of playing football at this level. So this is a topic that's not going away anytime soon. And I do believe that the alternative from allowing a kid to profit at college, look, it gets rid of that, right? The NCAA Board of Governors last week announced that it's going to support a plan that would allow college athletes more opportunities to make money while they're at school. Well, under Harbaugh's proposal, that pretty much gets rid of that need. If you don't like the way you're marketed, go pro. You no longer have to stay put in the NCAA. Now, while Harbaugh has written this open letter, this is not a new topic for him. He mentioned that he wanted to see changes in the NFL draft after California passed a law last fall that pretty much prompted image and likeness rules. And remember, we had Ed O'Bannon on the show to talk about that. It's a fascinating conversation, and it's a rabbit hole I don't necessarily want to go down at the moment. But Harbaugh's proposal includes stipulations that would maintain goals of players, making sure they get their diplomas. Under his plan, schools would be responsible for covering the cost of a player's education for different lengths at a time, depending on how long that player was a member of the football program. So if a player left for the draft after his freshman season, the school would be responsible for paying for one additional year of education. So yes, this particular plan is very friendly to the kids, but you got to look at it from Harbaugh's standpoint as well. He's a college football coach at a major university. So by allowing players in some form to profit off of their name while they're at school, it does offer some eligibility and amateur questions. And I think this eliminates a lot of it. I think it's an interesting topic, and it's definitely one that we should talk about a little bit later on because, again, right now it's the perfect time to have these kinds of conversations. That's really the lead story in the national sports front right now. Harbaugh and his idea of maybe changing things up. Even though the NFL draft is over, it's still fresh in everyone's mind. So it's a perfect time to have these conversations. Outside of that, not a lot going on. I mean, really, Giannis Antetokounmpo, he had his social media accounts hacked this afternoon. And now the Milwaukee Bucks, they have an ongoing investigation going on. I guess there was a series of foul-mouthed tweets that were posted from Antetokounmpo's Twitter account. His agent told ESPN that Giannis was not responsible for them. The tweets have been removed. Apparently, it wasn't only his social media accounts. Apparently, his Twitter, phone, email, and bank accounts were also hacked. So if you saw an inappropriate message from Giannis Antetokounmpo on your Twitter account earlier today, it didn't come from the Greek freak. The Milwaukee Bucks already have an investigation ongoing for someone hacking his account. Let's take a break for just a moment. Local sports recap is coming up. And again, we're going to be joined by Larry Pepe. Plus, we're going to take a trip down memory lane and talk about starting lineups. That's coming up on this edition of Drive Time Sports. We're live from the Auto Farm Studios.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's main event.
Don't call it a comeback.
We're back on Drive Time Sports, gearing up for some live sports action this weekend. Boy, it's been a long time since we've been able to say that. Of course, NASCAR is going to be making its return here on KOAL on May 17th, but NASCAR will not be the first major sport in this country to return. Saturday, UFC will return with a long-awaited UFC 249. Jacksonville is going to be the location for this really stacked card. And joining us right now to talk about everything that is coming up at UFC 249, we have Larry Pepe. And Larry, it is a pleasure to get you back on. We know now we will get some UFC action this weekend. The last time we had you on the show, it was close to hopeless, and that turned out to be factual, right? It wasn't going to happen. It wasn't logical. Here we are, May 9th. We're going to actually get some UFC action.
Yeah, we are, and it's going to be interesting to see what actual protocols are used. I do know that an email went out to the fighters on the card kind of detailing some of what was going to be done, that they're going to be doing the nasal testing on the fighters. They are also going to be doing antibody testing, which, to be honest, is of no value to staging the event, because an antibody test just tells you if you had it at some point in the past. And we don't know yet if having it in the past means you're immune to it going forward. There's debate about that in the medical community. So I'm not sure why they're doing that test, but the relevant test is the nasal swab. They are doing that. Apparently, they're doing the one that requires like about a 24-hour turnaround. But what we don't know is how frequently those tests will be done. And we do know they said there will be daily medical testing, but I believe that they are referring to temperature checks and symptom checks and things like that. So at least we know that some testing for the actual virus is going to be done on everyone participating. I think that's a good sign that there is going to be medical oversight. The only thing that's troublesome about the email is at the end of it basically has this legalese that they can change anything they want whenever they find and all that type of stuff. So hopefully they will stick to a regimen that lets the fighters get in there feeling comfortable that they're not being exposed. But if you remember, when they were going to do the first event, and you had me on and I told you I did not think it was going to happen, they were not going to have any commission overseeing things. Now the Florida Commission is overseeing things. They had made no commitment to any coronavirus testing at all. They just said, everyone's going to be safe, whatever that meant. So at least now you do have the Florida State Athletic Commission overseeing the event. At least you have medical protocol to some degree in place, even though not fully committed to with the legalese paragraph. But at least there are things in place where we're being told that this testing is going to be done. And I saw a scroll. I had recommended that the cage be, you know, sanitized in between fights. There was no discussion of that when they were going to do the event in California. Now I saw on ESPN scroll last night that they are working out details to sanitize the cage in between fights. So I'm glad to see that those protocols are in place. It's fun to think about live sports again, let alone live fighting for me, since that's my thing. So let's see how it all pans out, and they're definitely coming out of the gate fast and hard with a very strong card this Saturday and then two cards in the next 7 days after that, one on, I believe, the following Wednesday and then another one the following Saturday. So if this all goes well, I think the UFC will be back for the foreseeable future.
No question, and I think it is a big step forward for sports in this country in general. Now, with that being said, you talked about a very strong card in the headlining fight, lightweight bout, Tony Ferguson going up against Justin Gaethje. You and I had a conversation off of the cuff about this, Larry. It's one of those fights where the action should be good, should be steady throughout, but it doesn't carry a lot of name recognition. I don't know if that's going to be a factor or not, because, look, we may be so starved for any sort of live sporting event. In fact, I know we are. We have people tuning in to watch freaking athletes playing video games, for crying out loud, right? So I don't know if the name recognition will cause a huge ripple effect as far as the amount of purchases, but it won't help its cause any, that's for sure.
Yeah, so here's the thing. Gaethje and Ferguson definitely have name recognition, you know, within the sport. I mean, they are two of the best lightweights in the world. Tony Ferguson on a 12-fight win streak, an absolute beast. He held the interim title at one time, was scheduled to fight Habib five times this last time for the title at the previous UFC 249 that went bye-bye. And Gaethje was a world champion in a prior organization, has looked great in his last three fights, has main evented a couple of cards, not pay-per-views, but a couple of other cards. So they're... It's not that they're not known at all, but if you go up to, you know, the casual fan, they probably aren't all that familiar with Justin. They may know Tony because he's been around a long time and he's been on a big fight win streak, but, they, you know, it's not the type of fight that really had the kind of promotion behind it that you would expect for a fight of this magnitude, but it's a hell of a fight, and they're fighting for the interim belt. Whoever wins this is supposed to fight Habib Nurmagomedov later in the year to unify the belts and so on. And it is a can't-miss fight. And we always hesitate to say that because those are the fights that sometimes miss. But their fight styles and what's on the line, it is very difficult to see a scenario where this fight does not deliver tremendous action. And I think what it's going to come down to is Gaethje, I think, has the advantage early. And the longer the fight goes on, that advantage switches to Ferguson. Because Ferguson tends to not be a super fast starter, kind of takes a little time, maybe a round or so, to get in his groove, for lack of a better word. Gaethje, on the other hand, has tremendous power. I think that Ferguson's chin is somewhat speculative. We saw him get knocked down by Anthony Pettis. We saw him almost get knocked out by Lando Venata, you know, who's not even elite in the division, on short notice. So he's there for the taking early. But if you don't get him early, as the fight goes on, his pace, he never, ever gets tired. Justin does tend to get tired as the rounds wear off. When you get tired, the power starts to go. And Ferguson just overwhelms people with what I would call volume of punishment. And it doesn't start early, but once it starts coming, it just never stops. And that's why I think it's critical if Justin is gonna take the fight. I don't see any scenario where he decisions Ferguson. And I don't see any scenario where he knocks him out late. So I think for Justin to win, he's got to use his power and take Ferguson out in the first two rounds. After that, I think it will just be accumulation of damage to a stoppage for Ferguson. But I think it's going to be a hell of a fight either way.
Yeah, we could talk about some of the other fights on the main card, but I do want to go to the preliminary card, which will be on ESPN. You'll get a chance to see Donald Cerrone. It's the first time we've seen Cowboy since his bout with Conor McGregor. Boy, it seems like it was forever ago, but it really wasn't that long ago. I believe it was just in January, so you don't have to go back too far for that one. And he goes toe-to-toe with Anthony Pettis, really for a fight that's going to be on the prelim card on ESPN. I don't know that you could ask for more in the terms, I guess, of a free fight.
No, I mean, I think, look, let's be honest, neither one of these fighters is on the upside of their career. Neither one of them is the fighter that they were when they met the first time. When they met the first time, they were both in their prime. They were both elite. And Pettis devastated Cerrone early with a body kick and just shut the lights out. And that was all she wrote. Now, they have both gone through lots of trials and tribulations. They've gone up to 170 pounds, back down to 155 pounds. Pettis even had a run at 145 pounds, trying to reestablish his career. That didn't work. Now they're doing this fight at 170, where they won't have to cut weight, and they can, you know, just not worry about that aspect of things. It's a fun fight, and it's an intriguing fight because they've both faded a bit, right? So if either one of them were in their prime, fighting this version of the other fighter, it would probably be a walkover. But because they both regressed a bit, kind of almost symmetrically in some ways, I think it's a very intriguing fight, and it's a fun fight. They're both fantastic on the feet, and they're both fantastic on the ground. If Cerrone were going to go in with a game plan to really try to win the fight as opposed to just go have fun, then you would see him, because he's the better wrestler and the bigger guy, you would see him push Pettis against the cage, go for takedowns, not allow Pettis to operate in space, and take the fight over that way. That is generally how Anthony Pettis gets beat. But Cerrone's unlikely to do that. He's more into the fan-friendly, I want to stand and bang and have fun type of fight, and that's one of the reasons that people love him. It's also one of the reasons he sometimes loses fights he shouldn't lose. So it'll be interesting to see, coming off of what I think he sees as a somewhat embarrassing loss to Conor McGregor, because by his words this week, he just wasn't there, he didn't show up, he didn't want to be there, etc. You know, this is his opportunity to bounce back and get in the win column, but will he be more concerned with winning, or will he be more concerned with being entertaining? And those two may not lead to the same fight. So I think it'll be a very fun fight to watch, with two guys in very, very similar places in their career.
Yeah, and look, I've always tried, there are similarities to MMA and to boxing. One of the things that we have talked about, I mean, the zero is coveted in boxing when we're talking about win-loss record. That's definitely not the case in MMA. But when you look at a guy like Anthony Pettis, correct me if I'm wrong here, Larry, I think he's 4-8 in his last 12 fights, yet this guy still has appeal. That just right. doesn't seem normal to me.
Yeah, I think the reason is that he still has flashes of brilliance in there, right? Like, you know, you saw him in the Wonderboy fight where he's getting dominated by Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. And then he, out of nowhere, comes up and lands this one big shot that puts Thompson unconscious. You know, people still remember the Showtime kick where he beat Ben Henderson in the final WEC card to capture the WEC lightweight title by literally running up the side of the cage and kicking Ben Henderson in the face in the fifth round and knocking him down. And that was the round that sealed the decision for Pettis. So he has these flashes of, you know, his nickname is Showtime, and he has these flashes where he just looks like not human in there doing fun things. But then, you know, to your point, he loses a lot of fights because he's not the same fighter. We don't see that brilliance as often. And people have figured out the game plan to beat him. And I think with Donald, you know, does Donald show up or does Cowboy show up? Donald showed up against Conor McGregor, and it was like he wasn't even there. When Cowboy shows up, the bite down on your mouthpiece and just go after it type of fighter, that's a really fun fighter to watch too. So I think it's a complete wild card. I think if Cowboy shows up, he's got a great chance of winning the fight. But if Donald shows up, we know how that one finishes.
Larry Pepe, again, our guest, talking UFC 249 live sports coming up this weekend. Larry, I always appreciate the conversation, always a lot of fun, and I know we'll have plenty more MMA to talk about in the very near future. Before I let you go, please let the listeners know where they can stay in tune with your pep talks that you send out, because those are always enjoyable.
Absolutely. They can just go to peperadio.com and stick their email in there, and then anytime I do anything like that, I just email out links to people, since they seem to enjoy them. They can also follow me on Twitter at Larry Pepe. Last four letters are P-E-P-E.
Larry, I appreciate the time once again. I'm sure we'll catch up again real soon. Thank you and stay safe.
Thanks to you, my friend.
We've got to get out for a quick commercial break, but we do have plenty more Drive Time Sports coming up. When we return, we are going to take a trip down memory lane. Let's spark some nostalgia on the show today. Remember the toys growing up, starting lineups? You remember these toys from Kenner? We're going to talk about starting lineups. How did such an idea become about? Who invented starting lineups? And what happened to them? I think it's an interesting story. I've been researching this for quite a while because the toys were such a big part of my childhood. We're going to talk about that when we return right here on Drive Time Sports.
This is Evel Knievel and the Evel Knievel Shock Absorbing Evel Knievel. And for that big jump, here's Evel. Up and over that 4-foot ditch.
From Kenner's Star Wars collection, each sold separately. Large-sized Darth Vader with his lightsaber.
You WWF figures, they got way out of that connection.
I'll swat Hogan with my new Mach 2 master.
Man, Hulk's gonna put the squeeze on you.
You WWF figures so close to the real thing. It's like being in the ring.
Never leave her.
Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
We're back on Drive Time Sports, live from the Auto Farm Studios. Right now, not a whole lot going on, obviously, in the national sports front. And so that opens up the door for us to have conversations about sports-related books, sports movies, in this case today, sports toys. And I've held off for many years because we've had a great track record of getting professional athletes, well-known coaches, well-known authors and writers on this show. We've actually done a phenomenal job with that over the past 10 years. There's one man that I have not been able to track down. I have not been able to contact, and I have exhausted every avenue. Pat McAnally. McAnally played in the NFL for many years with the Cincinnati Bengals. He was a punter, went to a Super Bowl. He was an All-American at Harvard. He's really known for two things. One, by the numbers, he's the smartest player to ever play in the NFL. You know the Wunderlich test? We've had conversations about the Wunderlich test. I took it once here on the show. They give it to the college kids as they're going into the NFL. It's part of the pre-draft process. Pat McAnally is the only documented player to score a perfect 50 on that test. Again, Harvard grad. Yeah, it's to be expected, right? Well, it's pretty difficult. Only one person's ever done it, Pat McAnally. Two, he created starting lineups that were released in 1988. And really, McAnally's story is fascinating. As I really started researching heavily into starting lineups, because we all know about the toys itself. They started off basketball, football, baseball, 4 to 5 inch figures. They'd come with a card as well. Sometimes they'd come with a medallion or they'd come with a poster. In the early editions on the back, there would be like a checklist. For every team, you would see the 3 to 4 players that they made for each squad. So it was like pulling a checklist card out of a pack of cards. So we know about that. But the story of Pat McAnally and starting lineups, I think it's extremely unique. So let's start by talking about Pat McAnally. As I mentioned, only player to ever score a perfect 50 on the Wunderlich test. Comes out of Harvard. He's selected in the 5th round of the 1975 NFL draft. Same draft as Walter Payton, by the way. And you may or may not know that from 1934 to 1976, there was an exhibition game where the defending Super Bowl champs would play the college All-Americans from that draft class. So after the draft, this was a real game. And we're talking about the real Super Bowl champions. Pat McAnally was an All-American. He got to play in this game against the Pittsburgh Steelers, the real Steelers, Terry Bradshaw, the Steel Curtain. Yes, this was a very real thing that took place for about 42 years. That's where Pat McAnally's story on the route to inventing starting lineups, which made something like $700 to $800 million for Kenner, that's where it started.
From Soldier Field in Chicago, Illinois. It's the College All-Stars versus the National Football League champion Pittsburgh Steelers in the 42nd College All-Star Football Game.
McAnally, 84 from Harvard, 6'6", is in at the wide receiver position left side. As Bartkowski has time, 100, he's got McAnally wide open! Touchdown! And McAnally is carried from the field by two of his teammates.
All right, so there's the clip. McAnally breaks his leg. That Super Bowl champion versus the college All-Americans, that game only takes place for one more season. The next year, it was a monsoon. The game was called in the third quarter, and then it just kind of fizzled out because NFL owners didn't really want their draft picks going up against Super Bowl champions. I mean, we're talking about kids going up against grown men. So that game fizzles out 2 years later. That's beside the point. The big factor here is McAnally breaks his leg, and I've seen interviews with McAnally where he says, had he not broken his leg, he doesn't know if the Bengals would have kept him around on the roster. Right, so they keep him around. There's a couple of trades that take place. A couple of players are released. McAnally makes the team in 1976. He punts for Cincinnati from 76 to 1985. He did play a little bit of wide receiver as well, but he's known as a punter for the Cincinnati Bengals. So that's 9 years he plays for the Bengals. During his time with Cincinnati, McAnally comes up with an idea to write a column for a local newspaper. It's called Pat Answers for Kids. And this column, it basically allows parents to ask questions about their kids. How do they throw the football properly? How does my kid get into shape in this route? Pat pitches it to a local newspaper in Cincinnati, and he sells the column for $50. Big deal, $50, right? This is where Pat McAnally, business-wise, was on another level. He sold that particular piece to that newspaper for $50. He's into it for syndication. While he's with the Bengals, every time the team goes on the road, he goes to that city's local newspaper and he pitches to sell that column again for $50. It's syndicated. Before you know it, Pat McAnally is bringing in all this money off syndication from a paper column that he wrote while he was with the Bengals. That's key to this story as well. Mid-80s, things start settling down for McAnally. He knows that football is probably coming to an end. He's not going to be in Cincinnati much longer. He sells his condo. The man that buys his condo is Bruce Stein. He's the senior vice president of marketing for Kenner Toys. He and McAnally begin to have conversations, and Bruce Stein realizes, I'm talking to a guy who's a professional athlete, Harvard grad, and he's been writing a paper column for kids. Boy, this works hand in hand with the toy industry. It's an adult who's been talking to kids. So he asks McAnally to come up with an idea for a toy. McAnally originally pitched him something about Dinosaur World, where dinosaurs played positions. Okay, that gets scrapped. McAnally and Stein go to the toy store, and McAnally picks up G.I. Joe. Now, here's a clip. This is from NFL Films, McAnally talking about the idea from a G.I. Joe that turned into starting lineups.
I've always loved toys, and the guy's name was Bazooka Bill, and his primary job was to carry the bazooka. They had built this whole bio around this character that had been created. I said, everyone knows who Walter Payton is. You don't have to make that up, so why don't we make three-dimensional baseball, football, basketball cards?
So now we have the idea of starting lineups. McAnally takes this idea to the board at Kenner. They love it. A couple of other hurdles that they got to make sure they jump. That's making sure that the players' unions can all come together, that the teams are getting their share, the players are getting their share. McAnally had been working through the back door. He had it set, fixed in the NFL. Later, they get it worked out with the NBA. They get it worked out with Major League Baseball. And here's where the fun begins for us kids and the collectors of today. 1988, starting lineups hit the scene.
Where they expected a lot of people to buy a couple, it was fewer people that bought hundreds. People would literally wait at these toy stores. Sometimes the employees would buy all of them and then sell them out the back door. They never got to the shelves.
To be a winner, be strong, be ready to fight. To be a winner, be fast, command the spotlight.
Only today's greatest sports heroes make it to starting lineup. Collect basketball's Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, and Magic Johnson.
To be a winner!
Detailed uniforms, every home team, and their official. Collect starting lineup, each sold separately.
To be a winner!
That's the NBA commercial, the original NBA commercial. And here's what's fascinating about starting lineups in 1988. They produced 124 Major League Baseball players, 137 NFL players, and 85 NBA players. That was in the first set. Now, I want you to think about that in terms of baseball and basketball cards. In 1988, the Fleer NBA card set had 132 cards counting the checklist. So in 1988, there were 137 NFL players that got their own starting lineup. Think about that. And from a collector's standpoint, here's what made them so unique. No two players were made in the same quantity. So you had your all-star lots. Those were national releases. Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Dominique Wilkins. Those were the all-star cases. Now the lesser-known players, the role players with on a team, they were distributed through team cases, and they went to the team state. So they were released regionally. So all-star players, you're looking at 25,000 to 40,000 quantities of Michael Jordan's, Larry Bird's, Magic Johnson's. Regional players, like here in the state of Utah, again, role players, Mark Eaton, Thurl Bailey. At that time, John Stockton, Karl Malone, they weren't superstars yet at that particular time. They'd be released throughout the state of Utah. Just to give you some of the names that were released in the first year, Michael Cage, Mo Cheeks, Paul Pressey, Rodney McRae, Sam Perkins, Terry Cummings, Walter Berry, Xavier McDaniel, Wayman Tisdale, Winston Garland. You see, they weren't all superstars, and that's what made it so great. I mean, I grew up a Laker fan. I had Byron Scott and Michael Cooper and Vlade Divac and James Worthy. Of course, I had Magic and Kareem, but you could find the role players, and that's what was so spectacular about starting lineups. Now, I bring up the regional releases because right now, to this day, collectors have the idea of a holy grail of starting lineups. Basketball, football, baseball, hockey, NASCAR, it doesn't matter. The holy grail. There's four extremely sought-after starting lineups, and they come out in 1988. Karl Malone, John Stockton, Mark Eaton, and Thurl Bailey. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that there is no such thing as a Mark Eaton or Thurl Bailey in the box. Because again, we're talking 4,000 maximum. Now, I saw them as a kid. I remember seeing them as a kid. Nobody really wanted them. In fact, I do have a John Stockton. My sister got a John Stockton. She liked him as a kid. It's opened. It's in good shape. But it's not complete. I believe I have the card. I have the Stockton toy, but it's not in the box. Still, it's highly sought after. As a result, the rarest and most collectible starting lineups to this day come from the Utah Jazz because, again, in that inaugural 88 set, they went out regionally with about 4,000 pieces. So if you have the set, an unopened set of John Stockton, Karl Malone, Mark Eaton, and Thurl Bailey, you probably have about $5,000 to $6,000 minimum worth of starting lineups right there. Now, they continue to produce starting lineups 89, 90, 91, 92. They produce them all the way up to 2000. But each year, they started cutting back on the amount of players that you had to choose from. So if you grab the back of an 88, 89 box, or if you find one online, it'll have the team's logo and it'll tell you which players were released per team. And going back to those numbers, the first year they were produced, 124 baseball players, 137 NFL players, 85 NBA players. That decreased slightly until we get to the mid-90s, 96, 97. Then it's gone from 85 NBA players down to like 20, 25 NBA players. And that definitely affected the collection a little bit. Because in the clip that we played from McAnally, he's talking about a lot of these never even hit the shelves. Right? I remember if you'd walk into a toy store or a Walmart, KB Toys, wherever it is, you walk into a shop, if you could find a box of starting lineups that was still unopened, you hit the gold mine. You have no idea what you're going to find. Is it Dennis Rodman with his red hair or his green hair? Because those two, they have different values, right? So when we got a little bit deeper into the 90s, you started to see the rising cost of sports licensing deals. Those became massively expensive. Today, sports leagues basically, they print their own money. NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, starting lineup, they're a casualty of that right there. The generation that grew up around starting lineups loved the idea of the hunt. And another thing that really killed starting lineups, it was the internet. I mean, for instance, today I'm talking about the Utah Jazz set. Well, when they were initially released, and if you collected them, and you wanted the Utah Jazz set of Stockton, Malone, Bailey, and Eaton, and you lived in Colorado, the only way you're getting that set is if you drive to Utah and come across them. There were a lot of starting lineups that were only released regionally. The internet kills that because you can get what you want whenever you want. If there's an online sale, say you're looking at a collectible from Disney, and the Disney store has an online sale only, if they sell out before you get one, you can hop on eBay and it's right there. See, it kills the hunt. And I thought that really, really hurt starting lineups. Took a lot of fun out of it as well. And again, NBA, NHL, NFL lines, they were all done by 2000. The final baseball set was produced in 2001, and it had maybe 16, 17 players. There wasn't a lot of them. And I'll tell you another thing about starting lineups. I have plenty from that 88 series. I have Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. They're not worth that much. They top out at about $40 to $50. Very few starting lineups are worth a ton of money. There are a few, though. Okay, so we talked about the Utah Jazz set. That's the holy grail of starting lineup collections. In 1994, there was a Cooperstown collection. For some reason, they accidentally printed Jackie Robinson's jersey with number 44 instead of number 42. I actually have this Jackie Robinson figure. He's not wearing 44, though. He's wearing 42. If you find one of those, nab it. It's worth a lot of money. There's a 1992 version of Magic Johnson. He was supposed to be wearing a purple uniform. Very limited set of Magic in a yellow uniform were released. That's worth a lot of money. 1994, Dennis Rodman with red hair. Extremely unique. 1989 football, Ken O'Brien with a misspelled name. And then there were very few boxing starting lineups released, but in 95 they came out with Rocky Marciano. Apparently, if you find one of those with brown hair, it's very, very rare. I'll end it with this. This is a funny story. Going back to 1988, when they released the NFL, Kenner had mass-produced Dan Fouts, quarterback for the San Diego Chargers. Before that 88 line could be released, Dan Fouts retired. And so Kenner had a boatload of Dan Fouts heads. They put it on the body of Dave Craig. So if you find a Dave Craig starting lineup from 1988, it looks nothing like him because Dave Craig didn't have a beard. And in the card, he's wearing his football helmet, the card that comes with the toy. Interesting tidbit. Dan Fouts' head on Dave Craig's body because Kenner didn't know what to do with all these mass-produced Dan Fouts heads. Starting lineups, big piece of my childhood, definitely a fun conversation to have, and hopefully now you'll go back and start looking at some of your old starting lineups, or at least looking them up online. We are out of time on this edition of the show. We will be back to do it again tomorrow. I want to thank Larry Pepe for taking out the time to join us. Always great to get Larry on the show and talk MMA. Until tomorrow, be safe. I am out.